I'm going to talk about some direct and perhaps indirect effects of the sun's magnetic field.
Yeah, maybe put one
mark on it. Yeah, sorry. Let's see what I do with this thing. As you all know, the sun is slightly more irradiant at activity maximum, about a tenth of a percent. But, well, this is certainly a magnetic effect, but the exact origin of it remains unclear. And there are many reasons to want to know this. One is that you would simply like to understand how the sun works. Also, there are people who argue that the sun's irradiance has changed much more than a tenth of a percent. In particular, times in the past, like the Maunder minimum, the sun has been, people claim, and you can read it in two or three issues of Science magazine over the last 2 months, the sun was half a percent less intense in the time of the Maunder minimum. Now, this may or may not be true, but to be able, if we understood the origin of the irradiance variation, then we would know whether such large wanderings are precluded, and this would give us better proxies for using other data to determine what's happened in the past. Now, ultimately, the climate is about the sun's irradiance and the Earth's albedo. That is the net power reaching us to drive our climate. And then, after that power does its work, it re-radiates into space. And so the temperature of the Earth depends on the solar constant and the albedo of the Earth. Now, I'm sure most of you don't think about the albedo of the Earth very often. It's about 30%. So the Earth is a pretty shiny object. And so the sunlight comes in at about half a micron with the sun's temperature, does its work, and leaves in the far infrared at about 255 Kelvin, which is the Earth's temperature. So this would change in global warming. Now, this part of the equation I'm not going to talk about, but I am going to talk about C and A, the solar constant and the Earth's albedo. Now, starting from the most simple-minded perspective, consider the sun to be a black body, then the change in luminosity would depend on a change in temperature and perhaps a change in the radius. But actually, when solar activity rises, it's the sun's magnetic field that's changing, but also the thermal structure is changing, and also the turbulent velocity field is changing. So what we want to call delta T here is really some not well understood combination of those three phenomena. And then if the sun's radius changes, say, over half a solar cycle by a few hundred kilometers, then the radius could be an actor in this play as well. So my principal collaborator on the solar part is Wojtek Jambowski. We've been working together for 20 years now. And so first I'll talk about what we know about the changing radius, and then I'll talk about what we understand and what we've learned about the source of the irradiance variation. So I'm letting part of the cat out of the bag already. The variations in the solar radius have been studied carefully by Brown and Christensen-Dalsgaard. Brown set up the HAO disk photometer, which measured solar transit, and he did this for many years, and he claims a very small change from year to year. But there are some people who claim that with increasing activity, the sun is expanding, and some who say that it's shrinking. And at this size, it would be important for changes in irradiance. So what's the truth? Well, from space, Emilio et al. Used MDI data to say that with increasing activity, the radius of the sun is increasing by about 6 kilometers a year. If that were correct, then it would be too small to matter for changes in the irradiance. And what we did was something different. Namely, we used seismic data, also from primarily from MDI, although I show you a gong power spectrum. And so N equals 1, 2, 3, these are the P modes. These are the normal modes of vibration of the sun. And for those of you who don't think about this every day and trained in quantum mechanics, you can think about the sun as a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator, and its normal modes are given by 2N plus L. The N equals 0 ridge is different from the others. Asymptotically, it's a surface wave. And it contains much information that's only recently begun to be extracted. In particular, at a high frequency limit, the frequency of a particular F mode, the N equals 0 ridge, that is, eigenfunctions with no radial zeros in the eigenfunction, depends directly on the radius of the sun. So if we compare model frequencies to observed frequencies, then we can compare a model radius to the true radius of the sun. And from this, we're able to determine that value for the sun's radius. In perspective, it's smaller than the value of hours from 100 years ago, which is basically the standard for 100 years. But it's quite consistent with that from Brown and Christensen-Dalsgaard. In the solar models up to a couple of years ago, everybody used this value. And it's kind of an interesting thing how truth gets forgotten. If you look at Allen's book in 1973, he gave this as the photospheric radius, but doesn't tell you where it comes from. But it's the same number as hours number. And I asked several people, and like Tim Brown, and we all came to the same conclusion. If somebody has more information that can lead to a different conclusion, that's fine, but and I'd like to know it. But what happened was, this is a transit measurement, so you're measuring away from the limb, you're measuring a little higher in the atmosphere, but you're not getting the photospheric diameter. So you need to correct to take transit data and get a photospheric diameter or radius like Brown and Christensen-Dalsgaard did. But somehow, just over time, this transit value became a photospheric value, and everybody forgot. Probably everybody who knew was dead. So now, what we would like to do to address the questions from the top, what is the change in the sun's radius with time? Well, we'd like to use the F mode data, and so we'd like to use a formula like this. And now the delta is the change in radius with respect to, say, activity minimum. But the frequency changes for the F modes are very small. And so now you begin to really pay a price for what happens at the surface. So you pay for the changing magnetic field at the surface, the changing effects of turbulence, and also you now pay for the fact that the F modes that we see are not really surface waves. Each one sees its own gravity, and it's a little bit subsurface. So they define a band sort of 4 to 8 megameters beneath the surface of the sun. But still, they have valuable information, and you can use a formula like that shown on the previous view graph to gain information about what's beneath this outer froth on the sun.
So can I just try to figure out the F mode is going to be sensitive, as you're saying now, to a certain acoustic structure, whereas in other contexts, you're actually looking for what's optical depth at 5,500 angstroms or something like that, optical depth unity. I mean, is it clear they're measuring the same thing, or is that even relevant?
You're talking about the radius itself?
Right.
Remember, we're taking the difference between model frequencies and observed frequencies and a model radius and then the true radius. And the true radius would be the photospheric radius. So that part we worried about that, but ultimately that's not the ambiguity. At this point, we have...
So the exact definition enters into the model.
Right.
And then you tune the frequencies using that exact definition.
Okay, can you repeat again the difference between MGI? They use F mode and Brown and Telescope.
Oh, they actually measured the transit of the sun. And then, so Brown did that for many years, and so Christensen-Dalsgaard actually did the calculation to translate the transit value into a photospheric diameter.
So they fix the center for the sun?
Well, no, you just watch the sun transit by.
What's transiting when you say a transit?
Well, you're looking and the sun passes by some point, you're watching that point.
So it's just some point source, a star, or is that all you're doing?
Well, you actually see you actually look and you define a limb to the edge of the sun, and then you wait until you get the other limb, and you look at the intensity as a function of time, and then it drops off as you go to the edges, and then you find some midpoint. So that's like something equivalent to tau equals one, and then you have to translate that into a photospheric diameter. So
there's an error, of course, because you may not know exactly the position of the star relative to the sun.
There's no sun. It's just no star.
Without the night ascension drive on it.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's call it transit. That's much easier.
Well, the problem that we had in using just this part is that things happen near the surface. So we add a surface term based on experience from doing structural inversions, and then we're able to separate the contribution very cleanly, to separate the contribution of what happens at the surface associated with primarily the magnetic field and the change in the radius, their relative contributions to the changes in the frequencies. And so then we can get a change in the radius. And it turns out it doesn't matter very much whether we treat the near surface term properly or not. Change in the radius is about a couple of kilometers per year, and it's shrinking. It's different, the opposite sign from the results of Emilio et al., and probably and it's about three times smaller in magnitude. But you saw the signal that they had, and it's kind of hard to fit something through it, but also they're measuring higher in the atmosphere than we are, so maybe there's some difference there. But all in all, it seems pretty clear that the radius change is not an actor in this little drama. But still, as small as this change in the radius is, it's not easy to explain. And I'll make a few remarks about that just to introduce a couple of things that I need to introduce.
It's shrinking at maximum.
As you go toward maximum, it's not quite the sun that's shrinking. It's this F-mode region.
F-mode.
Because we haven't talked, so I was a little sloppy there. So we've talked about this F-mode region, and now we'll worry a little later about the froth on top, which turns out not to make much difference. So we look at the change in the radius, and we follow roughly the treatment of Goldreich et al. And what I want to introduce is the anisotropy term. What Goldreich et al. Assumed is an isotropic random field as being causal. And we made a more general consideration and allowed beta to be a variable. So I'll only talk about two limiting cases, the isotropic field and then the one where the random field is purely radial. Now, there's physical reasons for wanting that random field to be radial, because you know the field is sort of radial at the surface. And you'll see what a big difference that makes in a few minutes. Just pushing this a little bit further. Let's see, how far do I want to go with this? Well, we're deep enough that the gas is essentially ideal. We're, you know, more than 5 megameters beneath the surface. So if we try to attribute the shrinking to say, the thermodynamic effects, then if we assume that luminosity changes like the irradiance, and as we go to activity maximum, convection zone is losing heat, and so delta S is zero, the entropy change is decreasing, and you look here, and then you can see that the radius is also decreasing, but the amount that is decreasing is minuscule. Let me just skip that. So, if we have a purely radial random field, then this band beneath the surface, that region is shrinking. But if you assume that it's an isotropic random field, that region is expanding. It's growing with increasing activity.
The radius as seen by modes, or the radius as
this seen is this is the radius as seen in the F mode band. So we still haven't talked about the region just above the F mode band, but I will in a minute. So, but this is important because the F modes, which Goldreich didn't have access to, tell you that you can't have an isotropic random field. You have to have a radial one if you want to describe the sign of the change of the data. So that's a really important constraint. And then you have to ask yourself, well, above the F mode region, does that same constraint apply?
So you're saying that because of the F mode data, you can say that the random field in the top of the convection zone is purely radial?
Not purely, but purely radial. Right, but this is, you know, I'm talking about two extreme cases. One is that the field is completely isotropic, and the other is that the random field is radial.
And because it's expanding, or because it's shrinking,
Right.
The only way to explain that is, I guess I didn't follow the previous derivation, but the important thing is that the only way to model the magnetic field can give you that result is with a beta equal minus one.
Well, that a field that's dominated by the radial component.
But what you're doing here is you're making the assumption that the actual radius of the sun is not changing, but you're seeing the effect of the magnetic field on the F mode propagation. As an effective, an apparent compression.
Yeah.
And do you have to assume anything about the strength of the field to make that kind of game work?
That's right. It's a fitting problem, and I'll come to that in just a minute. So, to talk about the radius, we have to talk about the last few megameters above. And you could imagine that the radius could change there by quite a bit for a couple of reasons. You have this rapid decline in the gas pressure, and the field can clearly change the convective efficiency. Well, this is an incidental point, but I make it anyway. The near surface perturbation you can describe either with the F mode data or the P mode data, but there's much more P mode data, so you can get a result. They're consistent, but they're several times more precisely determined from the P-mode data. So that's what we use to describe the last little bit. And now, here's the important thing. There are a number of criticisms that have been made of describing the changes in the oscillation frequencies in terms of a magnetic field. And in particular, everybody says, well, you need a magnetic field near the surface that's unphysically large. And so you have no way to describe the frequency changes without a change in the field, a growing field.
Random? Why random? You're talking about regular effect of radius and use the word random.
Right, but it's a random field, the magnetic field. That's what we're assuming is a random.
What kind of property is essential?
It's a radial random field.
Radial, I understand, but word random confuses me.
Okay, then I'll show you the field in just a second, but I.
Well, it's random. Yeah.
It's not.
But our assumption is distribution is random.
Yeah.
You want to include the fact that it is radial, but that it's not everywhere, so it is patchy. That's it.
Yeah. That's your guess. And what he's supposed to answer? What?
I'll let the man speak.
Okay. Some results. The thing that we calculate is the difference between the gamma, that's the near surface perturbation, at some year of high activity compared to some year of low activity. And it's a fairly, and it's right here. These little black dots are actually error bars on a line. And the fact that it's fairly frequency independent tells us that the causal perturbation sits very close to the surface. And we consider several functional forms of the random field. And one is, this is sort of the pattern that Goldreich assumed. And so it's a free parameter where this intersects here. Well, you know, it's just a form. And but the dotted line fits the data perfectly, as does, let's see,
so
the solid
surface,
line.
Where is the surface, left or right? Left.
And so what you can see is, one thing is that as you go inward, the field has to increase, but not any inwardly increasing field can describe the data, but still there's a broad category of them. However, if you take a form, say, of the form, a functional form like Goldreich's, then you get a field of about 50 Gauss at the photosphere.
Do I see beta minus 1 in time?
Yeah, that's, remember,
because of,
yeah, you're thinking of it, some other, it's just the anisotropy parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case, if you use betas plus a third, use Goldreich's isotropic field, then you get about 250 Gauss at the surface and growing to a larger value inward. But the 60 Gauss for the random field at the surface, its radial, is consistent with the observations. So the major objection to describing the oscillation frequency changes from the magnetic field is really lifted.
60 Gauss is averaged over the whole surface?
Yeah. It's at high activity.
It's a big fact.
Well, it's better than 250, but that's not so far from the results of Lin and Rimoli. So,
but this does not take into account the finite filling factor, does it?
No, this is like a.
And since the actual strength is much higher, the intrinsic strength is much higher, it could well be that. If you get a significant effect, a more significant effect than for the same amount of flux in weak fields.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been looked at?
No, not that I know of anyway. I don't. And you can also try to ascribe it to a temperature perturbation, but it turns out to get the same quality fit, you have too large a temperature perturbation at the surface, but not too far beneath the surface. You're in the region where you can't eliminate a temperature perturbation. So certainly it's the magnetic field here, but below you can't eliminate a role for the temperature perturbation.
That was for below the surface, yeah, hidden.
Yeah, so here's the surface. And so you're talking about delta T over T to fit the data being an order of magnitude or so too large at the photosphere. And so you have to go maybe half a megameter or a megameter, depending on your taste.
Let's see, so this is now your shifting explanation.
Yeah, I'm saying, okay, I want to now describe delta gamma, but I'm going to say it's all due to delta T over T. And so what delta T over T do I have?
Aren't MGI people see what's under sunspots now in temperature perturbation? So
yeah, and they have, well, no, because they see the same. They have the same problem. They see a difference in the speed of sound, and the difference in the speed of sound can be because it's a bigger magnetic field, so the transit is faster. There's bigger turbulent velocity, a smaller turbulent velocity. The temperature is lower. You know, there.
So, could all be a surface effect.
Well, I think that hopefully they're beyond that point, but.
But this temperature, in your temperature interpretation, you change the temperature without hydrostatic adjustments, huh? You don't include the shrinking due to.
That's right. That's right.
Because that changes the sign, the effect.
Well, it changes the whole sign?
Yeah, because the change in sound speed, the sound speed goes. As the root of temperature, but as the advanced lines goes as temperature itself, the contraction dominates over the sound.
These contractions are so small, I find that really hard to believe, that the changes are sort of...
The relative change is strong.
That was the reason my daughter was so surprised that they needed, in order to interpret the cycle variations, they needed, if you gave in terms of temperature, you need a lower temperature at the at maximum. Whereas even you would think it's brighter at that time, so the temperature is anything higher.
Right, that's what Goldreich says.
Yeah, but that didn't include the hydrostatic adjustment.
Right, but that was, yeah. But for them, it was different too. They used the temperature term to describe a high frequency change in delta nu over nu, which isn't in the MDI data, and so they attributed the whole effect to the magnetic field, the whole effect that's still here. So this is just sort of cautionary. So now to this, I should say that if you combine what shrinking you can calculate for the layer above, it's sort of no more than 1 kilometer, and it's shrinking, because otherwise, if you want to say that it's expanding in that layer, then you're forced to an isotropic field, and near the surface, you would sort of like to think the field is radial. But either way, the shrinking, either way, there's a net shrinking, and it's of the order of a couple of kilometers a year.
So now you're saying that, in addition to the propagation effect of the magnetic fields, there's a real shrinking as well.
Yeah.
How did you get that from the data?
Maybe we better do that later. I sort of skipped over the view graphs with all the that part, so.
What is this like a problem?
Oh, on to the next part. So now we've eliminated the change in the radius as a possible source of the change in the solar constant. Now the question is, in terms of the black body, delta T over T, is the sun hotter or cooler? And so what we did was to ask first, if you wanted to, let's see. If you wanted to describe the change in irradiance as simply due to an effect of the turbulent field, then you would need something that changes from minimum to maximum, with the velocity field being about 10% larger at maximum, just roughly. And so that's far too large. So therefore, it gives us a simplification in the problem, in that we can treat, then we just have the magnetic field and the temperature as the actors. And so we can, gee, we compared the numbers with your simulations.
No, but listen, this is a qualitatively very obvious effect. And I don't have to speak about simulations. The turbulent pressure at the surface is such that it pushes the surface about 300 kilometers out. That's a large effect, about one scale height. And if you change that effect by only 2%, you have 6 kilometers. And changing the turbulent velocity amplitude to just 2%, or 1% in the RMS velocity, is not a big deal. And in fact, you expect that if you have some more magnetic fields, that suppresses the turbulent velocities. This elevation of the surface is the reason that all the time, through decades, people haven't been able to fit the P-mode frequency variation. There's always been a discrepancy, a large discrepancy in terms of Hewitt's seismology between theoretical models and observations in terms of, and that frequency depends on frequency in a well-defined way. And that can be explained if you have an elevation of about 300 kilometers, which is what you get inevitably from.
Where would that, you're saying that just if you integrate the turbulent pressure all the way through the convection zone, you add 300 kilometers to the height?
Yeah, really it's very close to the surface.
So is it all, that's all concentrated close to the surface?
Yes, it's all.
But what large discrepancy are you talking about?
Well, the 10 microhertz difference that you're having from the surface level.
But that seems to be pretty well described by the magnetic field.
Well, no.
It's a different thing.
Not the cycle variation, but with respect to a given static model.
Cool, okay.
No static model could earlier explain the frequency dependence. And the effect was a big one that people worked on for years to understand.
Right, but you're talking about just at the surface too, right?
Yeah. Sure.
And this is a larger scale. We're talking about a larger scale here.
But if you move the turning points, that will change the frequency of any of the models except the ones that don't reach the surface.
So you would not be bothered by a few percent change in the turbulent velocity from minimum to maximum?
No.
But what are you saying?
Even more. Such a change would be measurable in the line widths. The line widths are a really good accurate tool for measuring turbulent velocities.
Spectroscopic line widths?
Yes.
Or heliocosmological?
You're not going to get the surface from.
Lines of heavy elements, such as iron, are excellent measures of turbulent velocities.
I can understand you're saying that turbulent effect the most important in changing the radius?
Yes. Turbulent lifts the surface with about 300 kilometers in the sun. In other sources, it's an even larger.
So all these previous slides are just going
up. No, that's the cycle effect.
That's
a different thing.
Yeah. It's interesting to have 300 kilometers to work with in a cycle modulation. Because then you only need a few percent of that. So, change.
Well, you want to change the turbulent velocity by 2% or 3%. Without changing the heat flux,
but that's a requirement. We can't change the heat flux because it's a thin layer on energy is conserved.
Yes.
So that layer has to do whatever it takes to get the heat
so
up.
So it's a geometric change in flow due to magnetic fields interfere. Or something.
And that's what people come to see observationally.
Can they amplitude change? Yeah. Amplitude.
Maybe Phil should continue there.
Okay.
Don't pay attention. Go on.
Well, there's some dispute as to whether or not we can ignore the turbulent flows, but I'm going to assume that, that we can, and if we do, then we can limit the problem, at least for the aspherical part of the perturbations, to the magnetic field and the temperature alone, and we can have a relationship between the magnetic field and the temperature. But for the spherical part, it's more problematic, more difficult, because you have to deal with the condition of thermal equilibrium. And so ultimately, we'll have to treat that, but it's not ultimately yet. So if we assume small-scale aspherical random field of this form, and we ignore the turbulent velocity term, then we can relate the aspherical parts of the temperature perturbation to the random field. And then we can express gamma in terms of the magnetic field. And I'd like to spend just a minute looking at these kernels. As you go to higher activity, the frequencies of the oscillations increase. And if you look at the radial part, radial kernels, they're positive. So as the field increases, they have the right sign. And if you look for the horizontal field, mostly they have the wrong sign. So in the treatment of Goldreich, he had the radial part fighting against the horizontal part. And so to match the data, he wound up having to have a much larger field at the surface and just and beneath the surface. So you can't. So the most economical solution to the problem is to have the field to be a radial field that is causal. And one simple model, just to assume that as you go inward, the field, the random field, increases. And then we calculate, and then what we do is, so the field increases going inward, and then at some point it saturates. So if you move the point deeper and deeper where it saturates, and then let the field strength be what it will, and do the best job of matching the observed gammas with the calculated gammas, then what you find is a minimum in chi-squared for that point of saturation being fairly close to the surface. And at that point, the random field is less than 100 gauss at the surface. It's radial. But also, once you have the field, you can calculate the temperature perturbation. And at that same place, it's negative. So that says with increasing activity, the sun is actually getting cooler just beneath the surface. However,
what's the physical reason for saturation? Density increase monotonically.
And because what happens below doesn't matter. But you were going to say?
I was just wondering that the magnetic field that you measure is the RMS field.
Right.
So it's the average of B squared that matters. Mm-hmm. So if the filling factor were, say, 1%, that's a bit low, perhaps. But then it corresponds to a real, let's see, say 100 gauss RMS.
Yeah, less than that, more like 60 or so.
60 gauss RMS. So that's a filling factor of 20% or so. If the intrinsic field were, say, 1,000 gauss, then this corresponds to a filling factor of maybe 10%.
Which is big.
Yeah.
We don't have extra.
But I mean, you shouldn't take this too literally, because let me just make a remark about the temperature. It's so rapidly changing at this region, so you can't even say whether delta T of T is positive or negative. And this is really such a simple model. And what we need to do is to have better values for the surface and force that to drive the modeling. And so at this point, we can't answer the question whether or not the sun is hotter at activity minimum.
No, it's much less than 3%.
It's like
3%. I feel better for that. Okay. Now, to change gears, to talk about the other part of...
What was the answer, hotter or cooler?
Well...
Tell us the truth.
I mean, the minimum in chi-squared is here, so delta T is negative. But look, you don't have to do much, so delta T is positive. So it's inconclusive at this point. But if you look how sharp the minimum is for the k equals 0 term, it's likely that the spherically symmetrical part is going to have better information for us. So that's going to force us to treat the condition of thermal equilibrium to do the proper job. So that's where we stand on that. So now, what about the Earth's reflectance? Well, about 30% of the incident sunlight is promptly reflected, and the rest of it comes in and does all of its complicated business and then ultimately is re-radiated at about 15 microns. So rather than worrying about all these things which are too complicated for me, we're just going to address this part of the problem, well, basically the Earth's reflectance. And I think it's fair to say that the Earth's reflectance is not anywhere near so well studied as the sun's irradiance changes. And also you'll see that it's not nearly so smoothly varying. So just to remind you, we've been talking about changes in this term. Now we're going to talk about this term. Now, if you look at ocean water, it has about the same albedo as the moon, unless it's covered by clouds. And then land has about twice the albedo or reflectance as ocean water, unless it's overcast. And there's some changes in the albedo because of the north-south land asymmetry. Land's where the clouds are. Clouds are what the whole story is about. Really, the story of the Earth's reflectance is a story of clouds. You might think that snow and ice cover would play an important role, but the places that are snowy and icy are covered with clouds. So, now, the classic way that you might think about doing these observations would be to put a satellite in low Earth orbit, and then, and this is what the climate modelers want, they want albedo for small, tiny little patches and to input into their climate models. But problem is that it's really hard to calibrate. If you look at the albedo results from satellite to satellite, each satellite quotes errors of less than 1%, and then from satellite to satellite, you'll see variations of 2 or 3%. So there are real calibration problems, and that's difficult. And they also, like all satellites, can fail. And in fact, there isn't one working now, and then you need a model of the scenes to interpret the data. But what we did was to reinvigorate an old program from nearly 100 years ago from Dangean in France, and what he did was to look at the Earthshine. I'm sure you've noticed that if you look at a quarter moon, that you can actually see all of the moon, and the three quarters of the moon in the dark are illuminated by this sort of ghostly light. And so and that's light reflected from the Earth, from the moon, and back to your nighttime eye. So by measuring the ratio of the Earth shine to the moon shine, you can get an absolutely calibrated measure of the reflectance of the Earth. And then just for orientation, lunar phase is called zero at the full moon, and then it's plus and minus 180 degrees at the crescent moon. And crescent moon means full Earth, and full moon means crescent Earth. Now, we have measured the reflectance of the Earth from Big Bear, and from Palomar we've been measuring the spectra of the Earth's shine. And ultimately the spectra may turn out to be more interesting. And my principal non-Big Bear collaborator is Steve Koonin from Caltech. And this is the Earthshine telescope. You really worry about stray light. And it's mounted on our 65 centimeter telescope. And then
it's a
bear skin.
Yeah, that's right, it's a bear skin. It looks remarkably like silk, but it's really a...
Was that in fact the Big Bear?
Well, the Big Bear would cover all of this. So, you put a filter on the moon. This is a quarter moon, and the filter transmits 0.1% of the light. You see the quarter moon, and then you see the Earth shine. And so you can see roughly at a quarter moon, the Earth shine is about 1,000th as intense as the moon shine. And if you were to take the perspective of being on the moon, then for a quarter moon, you see a 3/4 Earth. And the origin of the Earth shine was first explained by Leonardo da Vinci, believe it or not.
The Earth shine is the dark side of the moon, right?
Well, yeah, it's the dark. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's the dark face of the moon, but to connect to Pink Floyd, it's called the dark side of the moon.
Yeah.
We also simulate our results using models of scenes on the Earth from the Earth radiation budget experiment, and in that seat, the Earth is divided into, say, ocean, desert land, vegetated land. Land is partly covered with clouds, mostly covered with clouds, and the like. And we take our cloud cover data from the web from weather satellites, and ultimately running behind us will be absolutely calibrated values, which we can replace our values that we take from weather satellites, and hopefully those things will be 2 years behind us in another few months. So, and we take the snow and ice cover data from the Canadian Center for Climate Modeling, and so we calculate the albedo for the whole Earth, and we calculate the albedo for the parts of the Earth that we see in the Earth shine. So here's a typical couple of nights, just so you can get a feel for it. Look at the upper left here. The bright region is the part of the Earth that's in the sunshine. We're observing from California. This is near new moon rising toward full. So after the sun sets, the moon is following it to the west. And so the light that we're seeing is primarily reflected from Southeast Asia. There's a secondary grayscale here, and that's for the cloud cover. There are basically no clouds in the equatorial region, and then the snow and ice-covered areas in the north are also cloudy. So on any particular night, you see about a third of the Earth. Say, for a fairly small lunar phase, closer to full moon, you see a small piece, so it's just a small piece of the Earth, but you can observe for many hours. Near the moon isn't up for very long, but you see a large part of the Earth for that short time. So almost independent of the phase of the moon, on any one night, you see about a third of the Earth. And then here are some results. Here's observational results in the little black boxes. And here are the 24-hour simulations. The agreement is pretty good, but the stunning thing you can see is that the reflectance of the Earth is changing by more than 10%. This is a whole Earth reflectance in on the order of an hour or so.
In the previous slide, you showed that the desert albedo is about 23%. Where do you think the desert, say, and I see totally different range of albedo.
Yeah, because
numbers.
It's actually a few slides ago, but
yeah. So how do you reconcile with this number?
Clouds.
Clouds.
And so that 10% change is really due to the sun rising over a cloudy Southeast Asia. And the agreement is pretty good. This is a more typical night. This is now the moon going toward new. So the moon rises and then the sun chases it. So we're looking east. And again, we see about a third of the Earth. And you see this offset between the observations and the simulations. And this was really bothersome to us for a long time because there wasn't a real pattern to it. Sometimes the simulations would be larger, sometimes the observations would be larger. So this gave us a lot of angst. Now, in the observations, just to say a little in detail what we do is we pick a few fiducial patches, regions basically in the highlands that are fairly uniform. And then, so we have five on the dark side, and five, just the opposite here, but anyway, and then five patches on the Grimaldi side. The X's are the two points on the moon that Danjean used in the 20s. And Dubois up till 1960. So we take the ratio of the light we see here to the light that we see there. Now one of the problems, fundamental problem that we had to solve in this was the scattering from the moon as a function of the moon's phase angle. And this was one of the things that gave Danjean a lot of problem because he didn't know that there was a peak in the back scattering cross section. So we wound up observing the moon every night for almost 2 years so that we had full information about the scattering from the moon. And then there were a series of problems that we solved ultimately using the moon, say, the crescent of the moon as a guide star. And then all of our problems went away and we were able to measure on any one night we measure the scattering from the moon at any phase angle to better than 0.5%. So that problem was finally solved. And if you look on the web, there are all kinds of people who do this as a hobby to determine the moon's phase function. So we have these people who look at our phase function that are just living in a different world than what where we are. Now, and really interesting people too. So for the first 2 years, this is the albedo that we measure. And if we simulate the albedo for the same places on the Earth at the same time, we get essentially the same number. And then you think, oh, well, look, the error bars here are about twice as large as the error bars there. And of course, this is just a problem of observations. But you know, you're putting in the cloud cover, and that's an observational thing too. And ultimately what we learned was that this signal is real. This is not an error. There's essentially what we observe is a 20% variation in the cloud cover, in the albedo as a function of season. So from maximum to minimum in a year, there's a 20% variation in the albedo. So you really have to observe a lot to beat down the error bars. Whereas in the simulations, it's less than 10%. And the problem is in these scene models for the satellites, the treatment of the clouds is really too simple. They really have, you know, you have an input of a reflection from this angle, this angle, this angle. And for each angle, you ask yourself, is the cloud cover 0 to 5%, 5 to 50%, 50 to 95%, or 95% and above? So all the clouds are in four bins. And on average, you're okay. But seasonally, you pay for it. Now, we also have some results from 94 and 95, which was a time of much lower solar activity, and we found an albedo, well, at the one sigma level. What's a one sigma signal worth? You know.
Can you clarify? 10% means second digit, like 9, not the third digit.
No, it's 10% of 20% of this number, so it's 0.06. Is that what you're asking?
Right. As I understand, 10% of above of the yellow number is the second digit after dot. Not the third digit, not 7.6. It will be 1%.
If I take this number is the mean over 2 years, but it can, but from season to season, it can vary to point from 0.33 to 0.27. Okay, and then here the variation is somewhat less than half as much. So.
That's not the error bar.
Yeah, something is hidden that you
No, the variation.
Well, the problem is I have this large seasonal variation. So when I take an average through it, I get a fairly large error bar, which I like to beat down by setting up a network, and that's what we're doing. And then in collaboration with Dean Chu, who built the TON telescopes, we're building a robot network of reflectance telescopes so we can put one every 45 degrees. Just simply, it's a matter of large variation from night to night because of changing cloud cover. So in the same place on the Earth from one night to the next, the albedo can change, the average albedo for the night can change by 5%. So now, if we look at 94 and 95 results, where we don't have that many nights on the order of 100, we see a larger albedo, but again, it's a one sigma result, and if you divide those 100 nights into the nights where you see sort of west of South America against the nights that you don't, then most of the signal comes from those nights, and it was a time of an El Nino, so maybe we're seeing an El Nino too. And maybe it's because there was a camera difference between the new observations and the old observations. But at least this, what seems like a small number, I'd like to convince you, if it were true, would be
and
a pretty large one.
Change of cloud.
And warmer, yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's a seasonal plot, which is, if you haven't looked at it a lot, it's hard to see. And that's actually, now we have 3 years of data plotted, but I only show two, except for this view graph, because you can see the same patterns in years 1 and 2. And at this point, somewhere in here, postdocs changed. And so there's some problem here. We're still trying to sort out. But, you know, it's a matter of a little while and a transfer of technology. So I'm... Yeah. Well, you know, but there's a lot of software. I mean, there's several thousand lines of code to do all of this stuff. So there's some glitch somewhere. But anyway, you can see this sort of plus minus 10% in the X's, which are the observations, against the plus minus sort of 5% in the simulations. Now, just to say, if the 2.5% were real, back to this original equation, 2.5% translates to a change in the power coming to us, which is 10 times larger than the 0.1%, and it's in phase. So, you know, and there are people in Denmark. Yeah, and there are people like Svensmark who argue that cosmic rays seed the clouds. Basically, I would just like to know what the truth is. But if you look at the cosmic ray flux and against the simulations, there's a pretty good correlation. And I don't show, this is a 12-month running mean to average out the seasons. So I don't show anything from the third year. It sort of does this. But we still have the the error, well, we still have some problem in the analysis.
Do you really get enough ionization from cosmic rays to
Well, you know, if you listen to the people who are atmospheric chemists, they'll tell you that this is impossible, that, you know, this mechanism can't make sense. And it seems sort of funny that at the sun's magnetic field is full on, and it protects us from cosmic rays, that's for sure, known for 50 years. But somehow these cosmic rays with this huge energy are going to seed clouds. It seems bizarre, but on the other hand, stranger things have happened. And, you know, we don't have enough to say if this is true or not. But basically, we have the technology under control. And I think for us, what's going to be intellectually the most interesting downstream is the spectrum of the Earth shine.
So you support the stretch map?
No, no. I
looks similar.
Yeah, this looks similar, but you know, what are we looking at? We're looking at a couple of years, and look at the size of the error bars in here. And you know, if we had a network with 6 or 8 stations, then we could get error bars down like this. And so I think our hope is. Well, our hope is we'll have a 3-station network shortly, and hopefully we can see if anything happens down the declining phase of this cycle. The reason we want 8 stations with the robots, and the robot telescope is pretty well nearly designed now and being tested by Dean, is that we can do differential photometry and null out things like El Niños and see what the truth is. But as I said, ultimately the most interesting thing may well be the spectrum. So if we look, we see terrestrial lines in the Earth shine and the moon shine, water vapor or greenhouse gas lines, if you prefer. And also we see H alpha and other solar lines. But if you take the ratio of the Earth shine to the moon shine, then the solar lines go away, and also the lines from the last pass through the atmosphere.
Is it cracking?
I hope that's
no.
Yeah, okay. For your sake, I hope so. But now, since we've in taking the ratio, we've gotten rid of the solar signal and the last pass through the atmosphere. We have the only large-scale measures of the spectrum of the Earth, and so what we are working on and it is to invert these data to determine, say, seasonal changes in the structure of the atmosphere and in the temperature. And we've seen from winter to summer 10-degree changes, so there's some large changes. But we should be able to get column density and pressures, but we still have some problem in the peak fitting. And also, we should be able to see changes in greenhouse gas concentrations because simply the line depths tell us about the concentration. So that may well be what turns out to be most interesting. And people in the Crimea will observe with their 2.5-meter telescope and their spectrograph so that they can get the spectrum of this part of the world. So thank you. Oh.
For the one.
Maybe Bill can confirm this. Jeff Koons used to have a plant outside his office in Michigan that had, similar to this, had the solar activity, and that was the ratio of Democrats to Republicans in the Senate.
Let's see, yeah, I mean, Wojtek has one, and that is cataclysms in Poland versus the solar cycle.
And I can't conclude anything from just half the cycle.
Right.
It looks similar, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, but you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that for us, motivation for a network is clear. Just simply, you have these large error bars.
Okay, whether or not the
and large error bars here.
If you can measure them, is a highly time varying factor, which means to me, no, whatever the reason.
Is this, of course, accessible to measurement, to experiments?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that people should know how many ions it takes to see, to see cloud rock.
Well, there's this guy, what's his name, he wants to do this at CERN,
yeah,
to use high energy particles, Jasper Kirkby. You know this?
No, I'm thinking about the public reaction.
There are people who do it seriously.
Well, he has a proposal into CERN to use high energy particles to see if you can see clouds in there. Wilson, he hasn't been funded yet. He wants to replicate 1912, the Wilson cloud chamber.
Yes, sir. But there's something funny about the plausibility of this. Because if the Earth's cloud cover was so sensitive to cosmic rays, then that you could see this effect, then, say, if the cosmic ray went up by a factor of 10, say, then presumably the Earth would be completely cloudy or completely cloud-free or something like this.
Well, when you don't know the physical mechanism of how the clouds are seeded by the cosmic rays, presuming they are, it's hard to say where that saturates. And
well, yes, but that would mean that we are at a privileged location in granite space, an implausible location in granite space, because we just happen to be in the location where the cloud cover is partial.
Right. Right, and I agree with all that, but I want to tell you that I'm really unhappy when I read Science Magazine and I see people telling me that the sun's irradiance has changed in 300 years by 0.5%. And then, if you can say that, how can you criticize this? That's and it's more plausible in some sense. The sun doesn't change very much, but the cloud cover changes, and so the Earth is cooler. And you have a mechanism. At least you have a mechanism. In the case of the sun changing by 0.5%, you don't even have a mechanism.
There are other plausible mechanisms, like changes in UV affecting the production of ozone, which is then transported by planetary waves in the atmosphere. You don't need a change of 0.5% in solar irradiance to produce an effect on the climate.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is...
Those mechanisms are a lot more plausible than the cloud seeker.
Well, I have to say, talking to people in the climate business, it's a different experience. There's much harder edges to people's opinions. but, yeah, and... You can see this huge change in the UV as you go to activity maximum, and then what happens at activity minimum. And then you can argue on the other side that the solar wind at activity minimum now is greater than it was at activity maximum 100 years ago. So I think that, and if you put it in the context of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel, then from 95 to 2000, the proponents say that the strength of the greenhouse signal increased by about 50%, and the opponents say the errors increased by a factor of 3, mostly because you realized new phenomena that you hadn't accounted for before. And so God only knows how many new phenomena there are, and this may or may not be one. But
it's completely different effect. First of all, changes in UV, 100 times larger than total radiance 0.1%. The trouble is,
it doesn't take place
at the top of stratosphere,
right.
And the mechanism is how to get them down to Earth. Mm-hmm. We recently sent a paper, which is a subject which proposes mechanism and observational side. But its whole philosophy is different from Swin's mark and all this total radiance. But the atmospheric community, by the way, agrees with the only mechanism. If you go to a meeting of atmospheric scientists, they say, oh, total radiance, 0.1%, 10 minus 4 effect. We see effects, 50, 60% from and accounting cloudiness, whatever they do in their atmosphere.
So you're saying
this goes with the noise, but they accept UV changes because it's real effect to them. The only problem, how to get them down. So the order of magnitude effect, which Steve mentioned, is dramatically different.
Right. But, you know, you should also bear in mind that we're trying to ask the most simple, in some sense, central question, and that is, what's the net sunlight that reaches us?
I had a question getting back to the irradiance change. I guess I was a little confused about the, when you first showed the, you know, if you say the sun's a black body, you get a sigma T4 of R squared luminosity, and we see the irradiance variation, and I was a little confused about which. Are we seeing delta T, or are we seeing delta R?
Well, the delta R is eliminated, that's okay. For sure. So now the question is, what's the source of delta T in the black body equation, which doesn't really describe the sun?
Sure.
Because if you think about what's happening with rising activity, it's a rising magnetic field, and then that, as has been hammered on for a good part of my talk, that changes the thermal structure, and that changes they all sort of work in concert. Think of yourself as an oscillation traveling along the surface like this, sort of bouncing off the surface. And now the random magnetic field increases, and so that's effectively an increase in the gas pressure. You travel faster, you go to higher frequency. That's what the modes do, is you go to higher activity. And then, as Hank pointed out, and as these calculations say, as you go to higher activity, perhaps it gets cooler. That shortens the trajectory. Essentially, you're to higher frequency. And as well, if you go to higher activity, then the effect of the magnetic field is to sort of suppress the turbulent flow. And the turbulent flow, as Aki said, serves to increase the turbulent pressure, serves to increase the radius. So that's a little weaker, it's a little smaller, again, goes to higher frequency. So all three of the actors in principle are in the play. And so then the question is more complicated than people think. Most people say, oh, the sun is hotter at activity maximum, but that's not necessarily the case. And we saw, I showed an example where actually the field increases with activity, but
yeah, I guess I can understand the changes in the, that you mentioned, the magnetic field, you know, affecting the wave speed and so forth and so on. That still doesn't answer the question, where the extra heat came from?
That comes to Hank's, I think what Hank would tell you is that you go to higher activity, the sun's surface is corrugated,
okay.
And so it's a more effective radiator, and so there's an additional heat loss, and that, in a sense, we see that because that's dq is negative, ds is negative, so delta r is shrinking.
Cooling.
Right.
But shouldn't you, I mean, in a way, what you're really doing is increasing the surface area of the sun. It's actually, even though you're not increasing the actual radius, it's like you're increasing the surface area.
Right.
It's like, you know, since the sun is not exactly a black body radiator, it's not sigma t to the fourth, but f times sigma t to the fourth, where f is sort of a fudge factor for the deviation from a black body, and that f depends on the corrugation of the surface, and that's why you're changing.
Wow.
But see, the point there, but also then, if you take that at face value, and I have to say I kind of like the picture, then at activity minimum, the surface is uncorrugated.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the minimum irradiance that you could have. And now if you go back to 1700, how could you have 0.5% less? How could the sun be any less corrugated than uncorrugated? So that's why you'd like to know, so you can have the best proxy possible to reach back into the past.
What's the modern minimum globally?
The rest of Europe.
Yeah.
Our modern minimum coincides with legalized age, when it was cold.
That was mostly a northern hemisphere, especially the rest of Europe.
Huh?
In Europe, it was not cold.
Well,
like,
but 1 degree or more on average, low.
It was not cold.
But there are, you know, if you look at, here's some things I didn't show, but just to give you a sense, a different sense about the climate, is this is ice core data from Greenland ice cores, and here's there's the current temperature sort of minus 20. And this is the most stable time in the last 100,000 years. And here's a period, it's called the Younger Dryas. And what happened was we came fully out of the Ice Age. And then for 1,000 years, we dropped back into it. And we apparently dropped back into it fairly locally. And this was a global phenomenon based on, say, sedimentary data from South America, based on dust data, dust and isotopic abundances in the ice core data. So big changes are possible, and these can occur on short times.
If you look at the atmospheric model, it's tried to model milder medium condition. They don't show uniform low temperature. They show patchy intermediate distribution. In some places, it's cooler than in the other quarter, but on average, 1 degree lower over the globe.
But how much in Europe?
In Europe, was more like 1.5, but on average, I don't exactly. It's
so
again,
was there ice?
By Dave Ryan.
But this is simulation. We were talking about the observation.
Observation was thermometer in Europe and not in Tahiti. What do you want from observations?
There are indicators that people have looked at this question. It was not just only the observations in Western Europe.
It was intermittent.
I would say the ice age is an observational thing.
Yeah, but they also take data from other places, say in lake sediments. For instance, if you look at the amount of methane gas that's in here, and at that time, say back in here, the methane gas would come from swamps. And so when it got colder, when it got colder in Greenland, methane gas concentration in the ice cores went down. And so that's telling you it was cold, so the marshes didn't produce marsh gas at the tropical latitudes. So in a sense, yeah, you can. And that's what a lot of these people do.
I'll tell you what, it's a little after 3:30. Why don't we thank Phil for his talk and many people. I wonder if he wants to stick around and talk to him.